Next up, we're going to talk with a medical anthropologist. That's right, about a lot of things. So get ready for that, and I'm sure you'll have a lot of questions when the time comes as well. Well, welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Sydney Ross Singer back with us, a medical anthropologist. Now, he received a Bachelor of Science degree from the University of Utah in biology. That was back in 1979. He spent a couple years in the biochemistry field. He got his PhD at Duke University, followed by another couple years at Duke in the anthropology PhD program. And he also got a master's degree. He then attended the University of Texas Medical Branch at Galveston on a full academic scholarship. He is a pioneering new field of health research called applied medical anthropology, shedding light on the many ways our culture is simply making us sick. Sydney Ross with Singer with us on Coast to Coast. Sydney, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me back, George. It's good to be back with you.
Aloha, I should say, to you too, huh?
Yes.
How are things out there? I hear it's been cold out there lately.
Well, I'm not going to complain. A lot of people listening to this show have it a lot colder than we do here in Hawaii.
Well, that's true. Were you there during the missile ballistic launch alert?
I was. It was one of those things where my son came running up and he said, "Look what I just saw on my phone." And I was incredulous at first. I didn't believe it. It just didn't make sense. But everybody was, and he was, young people, I think, were more panicking than older people who've been through a few false alarms in life. But yeah, what a boondoggle thing that was. Oh,
and then it happened to Japan a couple days later.
I know. Everybody's on edge. And the thing is, you don't know what to do if it's true anyway. I mean, what do? You hide under a coconut tree?
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. Cindy, well, what is a medical anthropologist?
Well, when I started doing this work, I mean, there's a lot more now, but it was pretty rare when I was doing this back in the late 80s. And I pioneered the field of applied medical anthropology. So what I do is, you know, anthropologists usually go to other cultures and try to figure out what's going on in those cultures. I look at our own culture, and I look at how the things we do cause disease. And if you understand how the body works and its basic design, then you could easily see how some things can interfere with that operation. And, you know, you can then point out how certain diseases are caused by certain lifestyle factors. And it's not just the things we do. It's also our attitudes, you know, our institutions, the way we approach things. You know, our food, how it's growing. I mean, the culture is everything that we're about. And it determines everything we think, do, and say. And when those things are in conflict with our natural mechanisms for health, then we end up getting ill. So we try to point those out, let people know these lifestyles may be leading to these diseases, and then people can make choices, informed choices on how to change their lifestyles and prevent disease. And that's the thing that's important to me. I mean, when I was in medicine, in medical school, it was really obvious that it's all about treatment, detection and treatment of disease. And I just was never really fond of that approach because it doesn't really help the person prevent disease. And to me, prevention, and to most people, obviously, prevention is a lot better than trying to detect disease once it appears, because that means you have it, and then hope you can possibly cure it. So prevention is very important. But to do that, you really need to be aware of how the things you're doing can be harming you. And we're usually oblivious to the obvious.
Right.
When you're doing things every day, normal, it's normal stuff, you don't think about it. And everybody else is doing it too. And you know, it takes time to reflect and realize, hey, we have an epidemic of disease. Maybe it's being caused by these things.
Were you studying to be a medical doctor and decided to stop doing that?
Yes. I was just, I was very disappointed in my medical training. I mean, it was so, it basically was, I think it's changed a little bit over the years. I mean, we're talking, you know, 30 years ago now, but the training was really like try to look at it, figure out what a disease is that a person's coming, a diagnosis, and it's based upon what kind of drug therapy you're going to give them. And that's pretty much what it is. I mean, they weren't talking nutrition back then. they weren't really interested. Didn't get any education in nutrition, and disease prevention is just not something they really cared a lot about. But that's because medicine is a detection and treatment field. I mean, that's what doctors do. And prevention often, if it's a lifestyle issue, which it usually is, you know, the World Health Organization says that like 60% of our deaths are because of lifestyle. And, you know, that means if you really want to help people as a healer, you want to look at their lifestyles. But people get very invested in their lifestyles. We have industries that make products that could be harmful, and we still consume them. If we know that they're harmful, sometimes we still consume them anyway. Some of them are addictive things. I mean, obvious things like alcohol, tobacco. I mean, these are obvious lifestyle factors that cause disease, and we all know about it.
Yeah.
And yet we still do it. We even have the government making money off of it with taxes. So these become institutionalized. And the medical field treats the disease because they're not going to change these habits and behaviors. I mean, they have enough trouble trying to get people to quit smoking. That's the problem. And that's what I call a culturogenic disease, and that's a term that we coined. And that means culture caused. Because if you think of people as cultural entities, you know, we're not just biological. We're not rats or dogs or cats that you can do research on and think it applies to humans or whatever. That we're not just biological entities. We are cultural entities. We do things to our bodies that no other animals do because of the way we eat and dress and work and sleep and you know, all the things we do that are defined by our culture that people have done in different ways throughout time and, you know, and throughout history. These things affect our physiology, and that makes us unique among all the animals. And so to me, the way to study this, and this is what applied medical anthropology is about, is to look at how these lifestyles that we're living, how they lead to these diseases. And you can either go one way or the other. You can look at a lifestyle that's obviously harmful and say, what could that be causing? Or you can look at a disease and say, gee, I wonder what could be causing that. And the first thing I do is look at what people are doing.
How much of this is common sense, Sydney, in terms of living a healthy lifestyle?
You know, common sense is a strange word because it's very uncommon. But I think some of it is common sense. A lot of it is stuff that, you know, that you would think, like, don't wear tight clothing. That's one of our major discoveries, which we're going to talk about, is what happens with tight clothing. Everybody knows that. And when you talk about it, yeah, that makes sense. But, you know, people don't think in common sense terms. We're not very, you know, humans are rational animals. We pride ourselves on our rationality. But actually, from my experience in studying humanity as an anthropologist, we use our ability to reason to rationalize doing what we want to do in the first place. It's not like we're logical creatures like Mr. Spock from Star Trek, where we just make logical decisions. We make emotional decisions, and then we use our ability to reason to try to justify that to ourselves and rationalize that it's the right thing to do. So when people point out things to you that you might be doing that's harmful to yourself, if you're invested in that behavior, you'll find an easy way to rationalize it away. And so common sense, which might be the logic, hey, look what you're doing to yourself, they're like, well, you know, it's all right, I'm not really worried about it. And we just cloak our common sense we disguise what's common sense actually by, you know, cloaking it in our emotions. And we just want to do what we feel is right and what everybody else is doing. We want to conform. Being part of the culture and acting like everyone else and is an important human trait. I mean, we are social beings. The problem is what happens when your society, when your culture is giving you behaviors that make you sick. And it's hard to beat that. It's hard to get information about it because you have so much invested in those behaviors, industries, you know, sometimes it can be, you know, very fundamental things in our society that we just take so for granted that questioning it seems almost absurd, and people go into like denial mode right away. So that's the challenge of this. It seems like it should be a logical common sense thing, but it's in practice, it's very hard for people to to live according to common sense.
When you wrote the book Dress to Kill, specifically for women with regards to the clothing that they wore creating cancers, mm-hmm. how did you find this? How did you stumble into this? And maybe stumble is not the right word.
It almost is. Actually, my wife and I went to Fiji to do some field work on a completely different thing, and she was pregnant at the time. And we were on a remote island, and this is back in the early 1990s.
Okay.
We were on a remote island, and the bra was kind of new there. And in fact, some women didn't even know what it looked like. And this adolescent girl came over to us, and Soma, my wife and co-researcher and co-author, she was hanging out one of her bras on a line to dry. And the girl came over and said, you know, she was like really curious about it, and she wanted to look at it and handle it, and she said, why do you wear these? And Soma, for the first time, had to explain something she took for granted ever since, you know, puberty. Like, well, you wear it because like that's what people do, you know. She never really thought about it.
Yeah.
And then she said, well, isn't it tight? And she said, well, you know, I suppose it is, but you get used to it. And that was the end of that conversation. And then about a week later, Soma discovered a lump in her breast.
Oh, my God.
And you can imagine what it's like being on a remote island in Fiji, pregnant with your wife. And
you have something like that happen.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was like, oh, my God. And we, you know, we felt we had to go back to the mainland, and we lived in California at the time. So when we went back, you know, after this long flight back and thinking, what could we have done? I mean, the first thing you ask is, what could I have done to cause this? And, you know, Soma's a healthy woman, vegetarian, exercises, you know, do everything right, you know, that kind of a thing, like Linda McCartney, you know, it was everything right. How could you get breast cancer? How could you get this disease? And when, you know, she took her bra off when we got home to take a shower, and we were looking at her breasts now for clues, what could she have been doing? And we discovered something like that was in front of us. Like I say, you can become oblivious to the obvious. When a woman takes her bra off, she typically has red marks and indentations where the bra was pushing and squeezing her breasts or all around her chest. And we took that for granted all these years. I mean, you know, you just take it off and,
nobody thinks about cancer that way or anything like that.
Right. Our minds went back to that woman, that young girl in Fiji who said, isn't it tight? And the constriction issue suddenly just popped into our minds, like, this is constricting the breasts, obviously. That's what those are.
Does this have something to do with blood flow?
Well, it's actually lymphatic flow. And that's something that people know a lot more about lymphatics now than they used to, because there's so many women have had breast cancer and had a breast removed and the lymph nodes removed, and the lymph, when that happens, you get swelling and you get lymphedema. So we know a lot more, people heard the word lymphatics more than they used to ever hear of it, because so many people have lymphedema. And the lymphatic system is really a hugely important and underappreciated system. You can't manipulate it with drugs or surgery. It's a tiny, except for lymph nodes, which are like filters that detect viruses and cancer cells and bacteria and in the tissues, and it drains lymph fluid. Because in actuality, I don't know how many people realize this, but your cells are sort of surrounded with fluid, and that's lymph fluid or interstitial fluid. And that's where the exchange of nutrients occurs. You know, the bloodstream delivers nutrients and oxygen to the cells. It has to transport through this fluid into the cells. The cells release carbon dioxide and waste into that fluid. And much of this fluid and debris and large particles or whatever, viruses, cancer cells, they all have to travel through tiny lymphatic vessels, which begin in the tissues. And these are microscopic. And they have one-way valves to keep this drainage of the fluid going towards the lymph nodes. And for the breast, most of that is in the armpit. And when this is a passive drainage system. Now, blood is provided to your cells under pressure from the heart, so there's blood pressure. But the lymphatics is no pressure. And it moves by the way this fluid moves into these tiny vessels towards the lymph nodes is that as you breathe and create a negative pressure in your chest, it helps suck it a little bit. As you move, the muscles will push against these vessels, and every time they're squeezed, it propels the fluid from one little area to the next by these valves that are one-way valves, and it keeps them moving one way. So it's a very passive process. So if you constrict your body with any elastic clothing or any tight garment at all, the first thing, even a tight watch band, the first thing that you're going to have constricted and impaired will be this lymphatic drainage. And it's really the circulatory pathway of your immune system. It's essential. It is your immune system.
Is the medical community, Sydney, jumping on this at all?
Oh, yes, they are now. I've been doing this now for 25 years. And
you were way ahead of your time.
Yes, and they're still catching up. But they're catching up. And over the last 25 years, I'm glad to say now, there are at least a half a dozen or more bras that have been patented based on our research. They actually mentioned Dress to Kill, our book on this.
That's right. I've seen that.
Based on our research. And they say it. And now there are studies coming out internationally. There have been at least 30 studies that I know of that have come out around the world about this issue, showing that bras are causing, you know, breast cancer. And the issue, the tighter and longer you wear the bra, the worse it gets. And essentially, so we did a study on this. So, to go back to my story, when we thought, could it be the bra? At that time, there was very little done on the bra with breast cancer. In fact, if you look back, in the 1930s, they knew about this. You know,
they knew about this in the 30s?
Yes, they did. The Mayo Clinic, which you've heard of, everybody's heard of, the founder of the Mayo Clinic, which is Dr. William Mayo, he actually knew in 1931 in the Annals of Surgery, he wrote about in breast cancer how it's caused by wearing constrictive garments. And that's why it's higher in Western civilized cultures, as you said back in the 30s, than in places where they don't wear bras.
Well, why did this skate by?
Well, you know, they also knew in the 30s that the lymphatic system caused it, blocking the lymphatic system causes cancer. But, you know, after what happened was, see, the bras in the 30s used to be very, used to be designed to push the breast down to make a boyish look for like the flapper dancers. So then in those days, small breasts were in fashion. Everyone, you know, there was male haircuts for women and they wanted to be small breasted. So they actually wore very compressive bras. And back then, doctors knew they were causing breast cancer, the bras. Then they came up with like the pointed bra that lifted the breast instead of compressed it. And they thought, okay, that's good because this is an improvement. And then the issue sort of got forgotten. And there weren't any really hard studies back then. They sort of understood it. I saw a patent for a bra from 1940 that said bras cause breast cancer. I mean, it was understood, but it wasn't like there were the health reformers back then just didn't focus on it.
Well, I hope you've helped at least one woman out of this kind of situation, because not a lot of people were aware of this.
Well, you know, when we came up with this in 1995, we did a study on this between 1991 and 93 on about 5,000 U.S. women, and half of them had breast cancer. In five major cities, we did this. And we
unbelievable.
Asked them about I'm sorry?
It's unbelievable.
Yeah, I know. We were the first ones to do a big study on bras and breast cancer. And we found that there was other studies there was one in Harvard in 1991 that found half the rate of breast cancer in women who were bra-free compared to women who wear bras. Put differently, wearing a bra increased your rate 100%. Then there were studies, but that was ignored. They didn't understand why, so they just ignored it. And then we came out with our research. I didn't know about theirs at the time, actually, and we came out with ours. And then following that, now there have been studies. The most recent one is from Brazil in 2016, and the title says it all. This is the title of the study, is wearing tight bras for long hours each day increases breast cancer risk. And they actually studied the tightness of the bra and the length of time it was worn, and there's no question about it. And
well, great work. Cindy, we've got to hit a break, but we're going to come back in a moment. I do want to talk with you about cell phones and what you've uncovered there. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, with our guest Sydney Ross Singer, as we talk about the medical anthropology. Cindy, my sister died sadly several years ago of a brain tumor on the left side of her head, where she kept her cell phone almost every day. And I am convinced that had something to do with it.
Could very well have. Cell phones are a real problem. That's another one of these culture-caused diseases. It's the radiation in the cell phone. You know, the World Health Organization classifies radiation from cell phones as a possible carcinogen. Jeez. Since 2011. And California just released guidelines for cell phones. That's terrible. I'm sorry to hear about your loss.
She was a fighter. She went through a living hell to fight this, but in the end it got her. But, you know, I tell people, send text messages and talk. If you're going to talk, just put on the speaker and hold the phone away from you.
Yeah, and another good thing, if when you are carrying the phone, you know, the antenna part that the energy comes out of is on the back of the phone and not on the screen side. So if you do put it in your pocket or something, you'd want to have the screen in and the back of the phone mm-hmm. facing out. But, you know, women have been putting their phones in their bras, which is another cause of cancer, which is, you know, pretty obviously a dumb thing to do. And the other thing, so do you know, by the way, another problem of the cell phones besides the radiation, do you know what the number one allergen in the world is now?
No.
Nickel.
Really?
The metal nickel. And it's because of cell phones and other electronic devices filled with that with nickel. And it causes dermatitis. So if you have like dried, irritated skin and you don't know why on your hands and you don't know why you have that, it's because of the metal you're handling all the time. Chrome is another one related to it, to this problem.
I got a cover for my phone.
That's good. You don't want to touch the metal part.
Exactly.
So the other thing about cell phones that I'm concerned about is what it's doing to people's minds. Causing increased suicides seem to be associated with cell phone use, especially in women, and depression.
Really?
Yeah. And the whole idea of, I mean, how many times you go into a restaurant now and you see people and they're on their cell phones?
All of them. It's crazy.
You know, what's going to happen to our communication abilities when you can't even make eye contact anymore with people to talk with them?
Yep.
And then there's the issue of when you're looking at your phone, a lot of people get a neck strain. I was even personally experiencing that, and I quickly realized what it was. But, you know, you tend to hold the phone like on your belly almost as you're looking at it, and you really are craning your neck down a lot, and it causes a lot of neck pain and back pain. It can give you headaches. So, you know, with all, and it's addictive too. The phone, whole phone thing is, the cell phone use is addictive. And of course,
I've got a friend, Sydney, I swear to God, he looks at his phone every 20 seconds.
I know.
Even though nothing's happening. I mean, there is no text message. There is no ringing of the phone. He just, it's a habit to pick it up and look to see if he has a message.
Yeah. Well, you got to know. I mean, somebody might be wanting to reach you at any moment.
Jeez.
I know. These are the things that, you know, we our culture is evolving much faster than we are, and it's changing things so quickly, and the kids that are growing up on it don't know any different. I mean, we're from a different generation. We see the cell phone as compared to what we had, but these kids are growing up on it. They don't know anything else.
Well, what's going to happen to them if cell phones have something to do with brain tumors?
Yeah.
What's going to do to little kids who some parents allow them to have cell phones at 6 years old?
I know, and their nervous systems are still developing. So the authorities are even saying, while the research on the cell phones, they say, is still up in the air, they're saying, you know, you certainly want to protect children because their nervous systems are still developing. And, you know, the cell phone thing is the same. It's interesting how the research is still confused on that. This is another culturogenic issue, because when you think about it, are you willing to, are people willing to give up their cell phones if we find out they cause cancer?
That's a great question, because I did a little experiment once and just asked people to leave their cell phones at home for a day.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody can do that.
I know. Yeah.
Virtually nobody can do that.
Right. Well, that's the thing.
They go nuts.
So when you have here we have a product that may be causing cancer, and yet we have 5 billion users on the planet with cell phones. And in the United States, it's at least 250 million people using cell phones. So everybody's using it. And if it causes cancer, we're not going to stop using it. we're going to end up asking the medical community, there'll be money in coming up with new detection and treatment for brain tumors.
Yes, exactly.
It's the same thing with the bras. You know, you come up with a problem that the bras are causing. And by the way, it's not just cancer. Cancer is the tip of the iceberg. Bras are causing breast pain and breast cysts. And most of the cause of those is the bra. And we're talking about 60% of bra users, 60% of women who wear bras have pain caused by their bra. And when they get rid of the bra, that pain goes away pretty quickly. And so does the cysts. And the breasts, if you're premenopausal, if you're a younger woman especially, the breasts will lift in tone within a month or two of ending the bra habit because they can start supporting themselves without artificial support. So we're actually doing a study on that. We're calling it, it's the International Bra Free Study, and we are asking women to join the study and be followed for, you know, it's a long-term study.
Is that through your website, selfstudycenter.org?
No, I don't have that website anymore.
All
actually,
right.
The website, it's brafreestudy.org, and the other website with all my bras and breast cancer information is brasandbreastcancer.org. And that'll even have a link to the study. And we're hoping women will join it and experience the benefits of ending their constriction. And we believe and we hope to show that this group of women will have much lower rates of breast cancer than bra users. It'll be like the healthiest breasted women in the world.
I mean, you have come up with something really strange, and that is that people can catch obesity and diabetes by shaking hands. What is that all about?
Well, that's a very interesting thing. And what that's about is genetically modified organisms that are mostly yeast and E. coli that are used by the drug industry to make hormones, human hormones, that are protein hormones like insulin. So when you have diabetes and you go and get human insulin, you used to get pig insulin. But now you get human insulin, and they get that by they took the gene for insulin production, which is a protein. They took that out of the gene for that from human DNA, and they cut it out, and they put it in, spliced it into baker's yeast. And a baker's yeast, the same yeast you use for bread and beer, that yeast, they know how to manipulate its genome. They've been working on that for decades. It's a very easy to manipulate genome. So they take these and they know how to plug them right in, and then you incubate these yeast, and in the fermentation that they go through, they produce insulin. So you then the problem is this: there have been accidental releases of live genetically modified baker's yeast into the environment, and the company that does this, Novo Nordisk, they admit in their environmental reports when they have accidental releases, and they've had several. And even if they don't have an accidental release, when they're actually fermenting this stuff, there's some release valves for pressure, and they're constantly releasing live yeast that produce insulin into the air. So what happens if these get inside your body? I mean, you know, we actually can have yeast in our body.
And you can get this by shaking hands?
Well, this is why. If it's in your intestines, if you consume this yeast and it's in your intestines, it can produce insulin in your gut that you'll absorb. It's like taking an insulin pill. And that causes hyperinsulinemia, means too much insulin in the blood. The symptoms of that are diabetes and obesity. That's what that causes. It's known. So if we have these in our gut, people know about probiotics and how we take bacteria in to help us with digestion and so forth. Well, if you get this yeast into your system, and it's baker's yeast, so it could be contaminating the yeast supply for baking yeast. If that did happen, and you get it in your body, you can get this problem, and of course it can get on your hands, because when you go to the bathroom, you'll be passing out this yeast. So theoretically, you can pass the yeast to other people and spread this problem, because if they then consume this yeast, it can get in their bodies, and then they can start having this growing in them. And it's interesting on a similar subject, which is kind of weird. You've heard of, this is a standard medical thing now, fecal transplants. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Have you had a show on that or something?
No, I haven't had a show on that.
Okay, well, It's a very strange thing. It sounds like a joke, but it isn't. But because people with Crohn's disease and other ulcerative colitis, they've been helped by getting the bacteria from healthy people. And the way they do that is with a fecal transplant. And it is exactly what it sounds like. And they found that when they do that from obese people, they can actually spread obesity that way. So,
how weird.
Yeah. So the bacteria that we have in our gut do affect your whole metabolism. And if those bacteria, the thing that I was concerned about with this whole story is that we are making a lot of hormones and drugs that are protein ones that are you can get out of DNA, because DNA just makes proteins, and it doesn't make anything but proteins. So if some like glucagon and insulin and growth hormone are all protein hormones, and you can get the DNA from a human and then insert it, and if we're doing that in bacteria all the time or yeast, and it gets out in the environment, and if it gets into our bodies, we can potentially have some pretty significant metabolic derangements going on. Like when you eat sugar, if you have this yeast in your body and it feeds the yeast, suddenly it starts putting out hormones or putting out pharmaceuticals in your body, and you don't even know what's going on.
What do you think of aspartame and MSG?
Well, they're bad. I've known some people have really bad problems with that. Actually, recently I know somebody with an MSG sensitivity that caused a seizure. MSGs cause seizures if you have too much MSG.
Oh, I don't eat it anymore. I mean, especially if you go out and get Chinese food or something, you make sure it's not in there.
Yeah, but it's not just it's not just straight MSG. So MSG is monosodium glutamate, and monosodium just means there's one sodium atom that's bound to the glutamate, and glutamate or glutamic acid is a normal amino acid, and we make it ourselves. It's very important, but it's also a neurotransmitter, and it's one of the major neurotransmitters in your brain. Normally, when you eat glutamate from either monosodium glutamate or any protein digested, like hydrolyzed protein, hydrolyzed vegetable protein, autolyzed yeast, all of these things break down proteins, and they'll produce an excessive amount of glutamic acid or glutamate. So even if it doesn't say MSG for monosodium glutamate, it still may have a whole bunch of glutamate as a product of other things. So you can look this up, and you'll find other sources of glutamate. People sensitive to that should look at that, because not only does it cause headaches and other problems like that, but if it gets into your brain, and normally it doesn't, but if you've had a brain injury or for some reason your blood-brain barrier isn't working properly, it can get into the brain, and it's like a neural poison, and it overexcites the brain and causes seizures, and it's actually a pretty leading cause of seizures. And about a third of the public is sensitive to just MSG. It's really a really frightening thing when you think about it, because you start looking at packages and you see where all the glutamate is coming from, and I mean, we eat tons of this stuff every day. So probably the best thing to do is avoid packaged foods, or at least if you're sensitive to this stuff, or at least, you know, read the label and try to know what you're getting in your body so you don't overdose yourself.
Well, I was going to say, Sydney, that more and more people are overdosing on opioids. Mm. And this is an epidemic. Mm-hmm. I mean, how can they mix so many of these pharmaceuticals? Don't they realize that you could mix the stuff and kill yourself? And they do?
Yeah, well, I know. It's when you have a pharmaceutically focused medical establishment, you know, that's what they're doing. It's all about pharmacology. It's not really about trying to figure out the cause of the disease to prevent it by eliminating the cause. It's treating it. And then you take each drug has its own side effects, and then you start taking drugs for the side effects, and before you know it, you're taking like 5 to 10 drugs every day, and the cause of the problem still isn't even known. That's one of the things that gripes me, about medicine a lot, is that they're willing to prescribe for life, medicate you for life, for conditions they don't even know the cause. I'll give you a good example is with thyroid disease. I have a very interesting theory about thyroid disease that some research now is supporting, which is that the thyroid is stimulated. You have to ask yourself, when you look at the human body, I assume, unlike most science doesn't assume the body has any intelligent design of any type, religious or otherwise. I mean, like, it's just,
we know otherwise.
It's evolution. It just created what it did randomly. But I don't agree with that. I think that there's a real a function built into everything in the body. It's there for a purpose that through time is evolved that way, and it's there for a reason. And if we don't understand the reason, like the appendix, you know, why is it there? Doctors didn't know. Now they realize it's an important part of, you know, it's for immune function. It also stores bacteria for the colon. After you've had diarrhea, you know, your appendix is storing good bacteria that it can re-inoculate your colon with. So it actually is like a bacterial storage area. But and the same thing with the tonsils, by the way. But when it comes to these body functions, why do we have it? Why would your thyroid gland now be where it is in your body? Now, the thyroid is responsible for your metabolic rate. It's like if you have too much of it, you have too fast metabolism, you're hot, you burn up.
It's like a clock almost, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. And if it's too low, you have hypothyroid, you're lethargic, you're dull and everything, it like closes you down. Well, why would you have such an important organ in your throat? Now, that's where the thyroid is. It's actually...
Is that the base of the throat, right?
It's right around your Adam's apple.
Yep.
Now, the Adam's apple is your voice box, right? And when you talk, if you were to touch your voice box, while you're touching it, you're probably even touching your thyroid. It's like...
It's that like, close, huh?
Yeah. It's like a butterfly right connected to the thyroid. So as you speak, you're vibrating your thyroid. Now, why would you want to put this organ there? Well, you know, maybe you should put it like where the ovary is inside the abdomen or where the kidney is.
Hold on for a second, Sydney. We'll find out why Mother Nature... or someone put it there.